Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Juliette Frumholt, filling in for Jerry Kenny. On today's program, Lake Erie algae poses a threat to Ohio's drinking water, and Community Voices producer Renee Wild introduces us to a local man with a unique way of finding water. Later in the program, Bill Felker with Poor Will's Miami Valley Almanac. Up first, several Dayton area small business owners are proclaiming their support for gay marriage in Ohio. In a press conference last week, the group Why Marriage Matters Ohio presented a list of those businesses who have signed on to marriage equality. WISO's Jerry Kenny spoke with Michael Premo, campaign manager for the group. He says businesses have a good reason to get behind the effort.
It's a tremendous source of momentum and enthusiasm to have business leaders who are willing to stand up and say that all of my customers should be treated fairly under the law, that all of my customers should have the freedom to marry. Business owners know that businesses succeed when everyone is treated fairly, when all businesses have to play by the same rules and are held equal under the law. They know that the same thing is true with families, that all families thrive when families are treated equally under the law, and that's not happening right now because you have families that are denied the freedom to marry, denied the protections of marriage, and we're grateful to have these small business owners who are willing to step up and say that they support marriage equality and we should have the freedom to marry for all loving and committed couples here in Ohio.
And how do you feel the overall support? Do you think it's gaining in your campaign? Is that what you're finding? And especially with this latest involvement with small businesses, getting them behind the movement?
Absolutely. We're seeing across the board, you look at the polling, 50% of Ohioans support the freedom to marry. That's up 5 points from last year, and opposition is down 4 points. That's a net 9-point swing in favor of marriage equality. And the response that our campaign is getting, our goal for 2014 was to recruit 200 small business owners for the entire year. We're already at 188, so we're 94% toward our goal. You know, our goal was to get 20,000 pledge cards signed. We're at 16,888. We're already 84% of that goal. So the response, we've had over 90 elected officials sign on in support of marriage equality. So the response has been tremendous. It's been bipartisan. Just across the board, people from all walks of life are standing up and willing to say that they support marriage equality.
Tell me a little bit about the process of approaching these small business owners and getting them on board with your message.
Yeah, our local organizers who are working in offices throughout the state basically speak to business owners, elected officials, volunteers in the area, and develop places where they think the business owners might be supportive of marriage equality, and go in and talk with them and sit down and say, listen, we need you to step up and speak out about your support. We need you to post a sign in your window saying that you support marriage equality to show your neighbors, your business neighbors, and also the community members at large that you're willing to take a stand on this really important issue. And as I said, the response has been overwhelming.
Have you approached people that have not gotten on board or chosen not to back the campaign because of religious views?
No, none. I mean, there's the people are not concerned about that. What people are concerned about is that there are loving and committed couples here in Ohio that are being denied the freedom to marry. And all of these companies, all of these small businesses that are stepping forward are ones that have worked with the LGBT community. They have lots of customers, gay, straight, lesbian, bisexual, transgender. They see all their customers as equal, and they treat all their customers equally. They want the same to be the case under Ohio law.
All right, let's talk about some of the Dayton small business owners who are getting involved with your campaign.
Some of the companies that we have, the Fifth Street Brew Pub, Borrowed Vintage, Clash, Derailed, Ghost Light Coffee, Jimmy Modern, Meadowlark Restaurant, Omega Music, I mean, we've Sherwood Florist, Tattoo Team Oregon District, Wicked Cake Creations, Wheat Penny, a wide cross-section of different types of businesses in the community that are signing on. What we also see is that with every state that passes marriage equality, it puts Ohio at an economic disadvantage. We want the best people to be coming to Ohio looking for jobs and taking jobs in Ohio. And right now there are all kinds of qualified people who would otherwise come to Ohio who won't now because either they want to get married and wouldn't be allowed to under Ohio law, or they're already married and that marriage would not be recognized if they came to Ohio. So we're cutting out a whole swath of people who are otherwise perfectly qualified for jobs that we want people to come to Ohio to work that won't do it because of the current state of affairs with the law. And we're working to change that because we know, and these small business owners know, that when they put up a help wanted sign or when they post a job opening on the internet, they want the absolute best and brightest applying for those jobs. And they want them applying regardless of their sexual orientation or regardless of the gender of their spouse or significant other. They want to just have the best people in those jobs. And right now, they don't have that because people are looking at Ohio as a place that is not friendly to certain families.
Great, Michael. That's all I've got for you. Any final comments, though?
Just that this is part of a process. We're encouraging people to have conversations with everyone about marriage equality. The more people talk about marriage equality, the more people think about marriage equality, and that's how we increase support for marriage equality across the board here in Ohio.
Jerry Kenny speaking with Michael Premo with Why Marriage Matters Ohio. The NAACP and Payne Theological Seminary in Wilberforce have partnered to tackle the issue of HIV and AIDS in the Black community. The civil rights organization says its research shows that 1 in 16 Black men and 1 in 32 Black women will contract HIV. It's statistics like those that brought the NAACP's health department manager, Reverend Kieran Sadler, to Payne recently to visit a class called What Effective Clergy Need to Know About HIV/AIDS, A Global Perspective from a Biological Point of View. The Reverend Dr. Ovita Fuller of Payne developed the HIV/AIDS course. WYSO's Wayne Baker spoke with her.
I am a microbiologist, a virologist, actually, that studied viruses all my life or all my professional life. Most of that was in the laboratory studying herpes simplex virus and training students and postdocs to do research. In the mid-90s and 2000s, of course, the HIV/AIDS epidemic became very obvious, and I began to do community workshops or talks even while I was doing laboratory research. And in 2000, I understood that really HIV is a very not strong virus physiologically, and there's no reason that we couldn't stop it if people understood that. Also, in the 1990s, I began the process of training and education to become an elder in the AME Church, which is a clergy. So I'm actually the Reverend Dr. Ovita Fuller. And that has allowed the two worlds to come together, one where I know the viruses, and two where I understand the influence that the clergy and religious leaders have, particularly in the Black community, but I believe in every community. So we have been able to or led to put together those two things to take biomedical understanding from science and clinical research to try to move that to the community, to mobilize the community using trusted religious leaders who get informed about the science and then are more capable of effectively impacting change in their community. So the course we now teach is called What Effective Clergy Need to Know About HIV/AIDS, A Global Perspective from a Biological Point of View. And that has been taught here at Payne, I believe, since 2008. Dr. Leah Fitzhugh, the president, recognized that she wants Payne graduates to be able to address the issues that are relevant to people, social justice issues, issues that the Black church are known for dealing with, because that's who we've been. So in that light, she has required that this course is now a mandatory course for Masters of Divinity students. So I teach it here as an intensive 1 week twice a year for students that are in the Masters of Divinity program. And it's always an amazing experience, both for the students and for me.
It's very interesting, science and religion coming together. You don't see that much.
I think there's a general thought that the two are not compatible, but reality is that's not true. And many of the scientists in history that you know were quite high people of faith. And the truth is, the two are very, very compatible. So what I have found is that if you get the truth that science is able, quote, to discover, it lines up with the truth that you can never discover in a faith, because faith, obviously, the word and the truth is the faith is what you can't prove. It's something you have to stand on. It's what you don't know that you have faith in. So when you put those two together, it's a powerful way to deal with many of the issues that are in our society now. And so that's what we're trying to do with HIV/AIDS. We're trying to take it from a lot of misconceptions and misunderstandings, use the power of the religious leaders who have that influence, who are right there in the communities, who have access to people all the time, who deal with illnesses and challenges that families and people have. If those clergy understand, if they really get it, they become a powerful community mobilization factor. Our work in Zambia, I actually do research on this in Zambia. I just returned from a Fulbright Fellowship of the U.S. State Department. I was in Zambia most of 2013 doing a validity study to actually show that the changes that we see due to or as a result of our workshops or what we think are due to our workshops are actually from the content of what we do and not other things going on in the community. So one of the, we don't just give the religious leaders the science, but we try to have a validation, a documentation, both quantitative and qualitative, of what the outcomes are. That way we know what's working, we know what to change, we know what not to change. And one of our biggest outcomes, probably the biggest, is that people understand the importance of HIV testing. There is no way we can stop HIV unless people get tested so they know whether the virus is in their body, in which case that's not a death sentence. That means that they need to then enter into medical care to keep the virus from moving to AIDS. If the virus is not in their body, there are ways to keep this very fragile virus out of the body. And so that's what we focus on in the What Effective Clergy Should Know or the Trusted Messenger Intervention, which is what we do in Zambia. This first got started, at least the research got started, the invitation of a bishop in Zambia who wanted his clergy to be effective. They were already dealing with loss of church members, family members, the middle generation. So there were vulnerable children. There were older adults who were left without their children, their adult children to care for. So he already saw that the clergy were engaged. He just wanted them to be informed from a science point of view to understand how to deal with this and that HIV could be conquered, that it wasn't something you can get in the air or by touching people, that it's only transmitted by four ways: blood, semen, vaginal fluid, and breast milk. So if you avoid those things, and you can, then you would never come in contact with HIV. So there's no problem working with vulnerable children, or there's no problem working someone who is sick with HIV or AIDS, as long as you don't come in contact with those body fluids.
Well, Dr. Fuller, thank you very much.
Thank you. I hope you'll keep putting this out there because it's very important that we stop HIV/AIDS.
WYSO's Wayne Baker speaking with the Reverend Dr. Olvita Fuller of Payne Theological Seminary in Wilberforce. This is WYSO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. This year, the amount of harmful algae forecast for Lake Erie is predicted to be less than last year, and considerably less than the record outbreak of 2011. But it's likely to still be significant, coating some parts of the Western Basin in toxic green slime. Under certain conditions, even moderate blooms can produce levels of harmful toxins that threaten drinking water across the basin. For Ohio Public Radio, Karen Schaefer reports.
The 2011 Lake Erie algae bloom was the worst ever recorded, even worse than back in the 1960s and 70s. But it turns out last year's outbreak wasn't much better. At a recent press conference at Put-in Bay on Lake Erie, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration scientist Rick Stumpf admitted he initially underestimated the 2013 bloom.
2013 was, in fact, the second worst. About an 8.
That's on a scale of 1 to 10. On that same scale, the 2011 bloom would be a 10. Stumpf uses a combination of satellite imagery, computer modeling, and water samples gathered by multiple agencies to create his forecasts. Part of the problem with last year's forecast, Stumpf says, was that July rains were unexpectedly intense, washing heavy loads of phosphorus fertilizer, which feed the algae, from farmland along the Maumee River into Lake Erie at Toledo. It was a recipe for more algae. But it wasn't just the rain, it was also the wind.
There had been north winds, which pushed the bloom to the Ohio coast. After that, there were stronger winds, which mixed it into the water. And as a result, you now had this very strong bloom pushed right up against the coast, mixed through to the point where the intakes were.
The intakes Stumpf is referring to are the underwater pipes where drinking water is pulled from Lake Erie into local water systems. On both sides of the U.S.-Canada border, more than 11 million people get their drinking water from the lake. That includes cities like Toledo, Sandusky, and Cleveland. During the algae bloom of 2013, at least two of those systems were in crisis. Last September, at Western Lake Erie's Carroll Township, water treatment manager Henry Biggert saw levels of algae toxins so high he closed the plant and issued a do-not-drink order for some 2,000 residents.
We made that call, I guess you could say somewhat out of fear, but definitely on the conservative side. We didn't want to take that risk.
Biggert says toxins at his plant were three times higher than the World Health Organization's recommended safety level. There are currently no U.S. public health standards for algae toxins in drinking water. Both the U.S. EPA and the Centers for Disease Control say they hope to release the first national guidelines by the end of this year. According to the CDC, high levels of algae toxins are potentially deadly for people, and even low levels can kill farm animals and pets. Biggert has since spent more than $250,000 in new ozone technology to kill the toxins, but he still sweats the consequences if he guesses wrong.
If it gets any worse than it did last year, it's going to be a real challenge to overcome. Even with our new equipment, I mean, you just never say never with this stuff. There aren't recall options. You can't send the water out and, well, wait a minute, you know, that was a bad batch, call that back.
Does any of this ever, like, keep you up at night?
Yes, it has.
Biggert says he gets free testing from the nearby city of Oregon several times a week during heavy blooms. But in Toledo, the assessment and treatment costs are high. City of Toledo water treatment manager Andrew McClure says he spends about $3,000 a day for extra chemical treatment when algae blooms are intense, an additional annual cost of over $1 million. And all along the lake, more cities are now looking closely at what they need to do to keep algae toxins out of drinking water. McClure says last year the city of Toledo also came perilously close to declaring a do-not-drink alert.
I guess we're prepared for it. We have good, tight communication with water plants all along the way, Western Basin of Lake Erie, from Monroe as far over as Elyria.
That's from Monroe, Michigan, to Elyria, Ohio, just a few miles west of Cleveland, nearly 100 miles of shoreline. NOAA's Rick Stumpf says that makes NOAA's weekly algae updates even more important.
We monitor for where the blooms are, what the winds are doing, and what the winds are forecast to do. So we will be using the bulletin and the modeling we do in that in order to address any possible concentration of the bloom on the Ohio coast.
At the end of June, President Obama signed a reauthorization of the federal law aimed at reducing harmful algae blooms. The legislation includes $82 million to bolster efforts by NOAA and the U.S. EPA to study and monitor toxic algae, for the first time including freshwater systems like the Great Lakes. For Ohio Public Radio, I'm Karen Schaefer.
Support for Karen Schaefer's Year of the Lake series is provided by the Ohio Sea Grant College Program at Ohio State University. You're listening to WISO Weekend on 91.3 WISO. I'm Juliet Frumholt, filling in for Jerry Kenny. This spring and summer, we've been visiting with people who work with their hands. We heard from a thatcher and two arborists, and today Community Voices producer Renee Wild has another story of a person who uses their hands in an unusual way.
Do you know what a water witch is?
A water witch? I don't think so.
It's a mythological legend, I guess.
I have no idea.
A water witch? It's one of those sticks you find water with.
That's pretty close. A water witch is a person who can find underground water sources. Traditionally, this was done using a forked branch taken from a witch hazel tree. That's how the term witching was coined, for the act of divining for water, or dowsing. Today, a variety of tools are used by modern water witches, including coat hangers, keys, and pendulums. Although the practice hasn't been scientifically proven, this method of locating water is practiced all over the world. There is even an American Society of Dowsers, whose motto is Indigo Felix, Latin for the fruitful search. When I found out that my coworker, Rick Burnside, was a water witch, I couldn't pass up the opportunity to conduct my own fruitful search. So on our lunch break, we set out.
I did not know that I had this gift till I was about 6 or 7. My dad was looking for field tiles to correct some drainage, and he was using 2 metal wires and walking around the field and locating them. So I tried it and was able to do it also. That was about 45 years ago.
Not only can water witches locate underground sources, some can even tell how many feet down it is, how fast it's flowing, and which direction.
Usually the wires cross when I have located water through a tile or a pipe. And then the wires will bounce the number of feet that the water is deep.
We have been trying to go witching for 2 weeks, but a streak of rainy weather kept us inside. This morning, it was sunny and beautiful. But by lunchtime, the sky had turned dark gray, and thunder rumbled in the distance. We took a chance anyway and headed across the street to a local cemetery to go dowsing, and to see firsthand Rick's claim that he can use his witching skills for more than finding water.
I'm a sexton in a local cemetery, and an old gentleman came through one day while I was there working. And through our discussion, he revealed that he was a water witch and asked me if I had tested graves, which I said no. So once I tried it, I was amazed myself.
We stood in the graveyard and Rick demonstrated this technique.
All right, this is Wilford, and he was just buried a short time ago. These wires will turn one direction for a male and another direction for a female.
And it worked. As we made our way down a row of headstones, Rick's wires would swing to the left when he walked on a male grave, and to the right over a female grave.
I'm not sure how it has to do with water. I think it has to do with magnetism.
I really wanted to see him find water, but my demonstration was cut short when the skies opened up and rain began to fall. As we walked back to work, I asked him about the benefits of being a water witch.
I asked a water witch to find our septic system, which he did.
Yeah, I could probably do that. No one has asked me to do that. The local village asked me to find a water valve once that they couldn't locate.
And did you find that water valve for them?
Yes, I did, within an inch.
I'm assuming that you keep this water witching thing on the DL, on the down low.
I don't have business cards, if that's what you mean.
Maybe he should. According to internet sources, water witches are in high demand in California because of the drought, and grape growers swear by it. As we parted ways in the parking lot, Rick offered this final advice for would-be water witches.
Just go out and try it. You might have the gift and not realize it.
For WYSO's Community Voices, I'm Renee Wild.
Renee Wild is a graduate of WYSO's Community Voices Training Program. For more Community Voices stories, visit our website, wyso.org.
This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac for the fourth week of middle summer. Deep in July, the tide of summer reaches as far north as it can go, then starts to slip away back toward the Gulf of Mexico. The rate of advance or retreat varies with each year, but the balance has always shifted by the middle of the year's seventh month. The day's length becomes 1 to 2 minutes shorter every 24 hours, and the countryside responds with changing color and sound. At the start of summer ebb tide, the land is on the early side of cicada song, and fireflies are still vigorous. Woolly bear caterpillars and Japanese beetles become more common. Thistle down unravels more dramatically when summer's tide has turned. Seed pods form on trumpet creepers. Catalpa beans are fat and long. Farmers and gardeners now count the days. 60 to 90 frost-free mornings remain in the season. In about 3 months of growing weather for cool weather crops like cabbages and kale and collards and beets and turnips and carrots. Out in the field, the second cut of alfalfa is well underway. The wheat harvest is nearly over. Summer apples are coming in, blueberries and elderberries are ripening, and peaches are sweet and warm. This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac. I'll be back again next week with notes for the fifth week of middle summer. In the meantime, go out into the high tide of the year and wade along its shore.
Bill Felker contributes to newspapers nationwide, including the Yellow Springs News. Bill resides in Yellow Springs. Poor Will's Almanac is also available as a podcast at wyso.org.
That's it for this edition of WYSO Weekend on member-supported 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, and online at wyso.org. WYSO is a community service of Antioch College for the Miami Valley and beyond. I'm Juliet Frumholt, sitting in for Jerry Kenny. I'll be back with you next week. Coming up next on WYSO, it's The Book Note, followed by Filmically Perfect.